Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. An unusually populous show today. Three guests. We'll hear from Viju Krishnan, one of the organizers of the farmer strikes in India, from Janet Lathrop on state and local minimum wage increases that take effect with the new year, and from Alex Peterson on unionization efforts at Google. Last week, Vijay Prashad talked about the strike wave sweeping India, first farmers, then urban workers. Here with more detail is Viju Krishnan, Joint Secretary of the All India Peasants Union, which has about 14 million members. The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP, an offshoot of one of the oldest fascist parties in the world, the RSS, I'm using initials because I don't want to mangle their full names, they've been running India with a profoundly toxic mix of anti-Muslim rhetoric and policies and a passionate embrace of neoliberalism. Over the summer, they rammed legislation through Parliament that will further squeeze farmers, who've already been suffering for a couple of decades at least, and will stick it to urban workers by lengthening the workday and reducing labor protections. These moves have been met with intense resistance. Farming is crucial to Indian life. Two-thirds of Indians live in rural areas, quite high by global standards. In China, the figure is 40%. It's 18% in the U.S., though you'd never know it from all the media coverage of the heartland as the real America. In the interview, Krishnan talks about APMCs. These Agricultural Produce Market Committees are marketing boards, which were established by Indian state governments in the 1960s and 70s to ensure stable and fair prices for farmers. Unregulated agricultural prices are quite volatile and can often fall below farmers' costs of production. There were versions of these marketing boards around the world, but they've been dismantled in recent decades with the neoliberal turn in economic policy. Here's Viju Krishnan with more. Times have been quite tough for Indian farmers over the last years, right? Epidemic of suicides, which we've heard a considerable amount about the West. What has provoked all that distress? Why all the suicides? Why all the distress?
See, it is from 1991 onwards, the neoliberal economic policies have been implemented in our country by different governments that have come. And the government has been withdrawing from public spending in agriculture, rural development, and such sectors. And we find a system wherein the subsidies for agriculture are cut. The costs of cultivation have increased because the input costs are determined by the companies. There is total decontrol. The government controls have been withdrawn. The deregulation has led to higher costs for all of the inputs, leading to more costs of production. You are not having remunerative prices for the produce. That is leading to a situation wherein farmers are perpetually indebted, and the agrarian distress is leading to farm suicides that have happened. If you look at from 1995 onwards, according to conservative estimates, more than 400,000 farmers in India have committed suicide. Those facing this distress, this number is surely much more because the landless farmers are not part of it. The women cultivators are not usually part of this. And you have a large section of the tribal farmers and others who don't get accounted for in this. So that is the severity of this agrarian distress, agrarian crisis, which is induced by the policies that the different governments have been implementing in our country.
To whom do the farmers sell? To large food processors on small markets? How's their produce distributed?
The small farmers in India, when you say small farmers, more than 80% or so are small farmers in our country. One is they do produce for their own subsistence, and in nearby markets they are selling. There are also in some of the states where we have had the increased production with the Green Revolution techniques and so on. In those states, you have a wider network of regulated markets called the agricultural produce markets, which are there in states like Punjab, in Haryana, in many states. From 1960s onwards, you have had states enacting these APMC acts, which are regulated markets. So you have the traders coming in here, and some level playing ground is there. Otherwise, it was directly that from the farmers, the traders would buy at cheap rates and there was no government control earlier. To avoid this, these regulated markets have come into being. It is these markets that now this government is trying to dismantle.
Yes, that was my next question. So there is a set of legislation that set off the recent round of protests. Yeah, could you describe what was in that legislation? How did they want to change the Indian farm market?
First and foremost is the whole world is fighting a pandemic. It is a big crisis. It is in such a time of crisis that the government has come with these three acts in the month of June and pushed it through the parliament without any democratic discussion or debate being allowed. The farmers had been demanding a legislation for providing a minimum support price for their produce at least 50% more than the cost of production, and another legislation for ensuring freedom from indebtedness. However, this government, during a pandemic and lockdown, while keeping the people under lockdown, are actually trying to open the gates for corporate profiteering. Three ordinances were brought, later passed as acts in the parliament without any democratic discussion. One of them is named the Farmers Produce Trade and Commerce Promotion and Facilitation Act. Another is the Essential Commodities Amendment Act. And thirdly, the Farmers Empowerment and Protection Agreement of Price Assurance and Farm Services Act. You have very attractive names and quite long names, but to put it in simple terms, the first act is actually to do away with the Agriculture Produce Market Committee. There have been repeated efforts earlier to dilute these APMC markets. Now this central government is trying to ensure that there would be no control on the big traders or big agribusinesses like Walmart, Pepsi, Indian companies like the Reliance or Adani's and ITC and so on to directly purchase from the farmers. In India, the poor farmers often are forced to engage in distress sale because there is not enough facilities for them to store for long period and so on, and they need to invest in the next season. So it is removing all restrictions on the private players who can directly source these crops from the farmers. That is one act. The changes to the Essential Commodities Act. Essential Commodities Act was brought to ensure that there is no hoarding and black marketing. In the 1950s, it was brought. Now, the government has declared that through this act, that the rice, wheat, different pulses, oil seeds, potato, onion, and such essential commodities are no longer to be treated as essential commodities. The big companies are allowed to store an unlimited amount of these different crops. So even in case there is an emergency, there is a war or a famine or big scarcity of food grains, these companies could retain their installed capacities. They could export the crops. They could use the whatever produce for agro-processing and so on. The government's only answer is that if there is a 100% rise in prices of horticultural produce and 50% rise in other price of non-perishable goods, then the government can intervene. It also seems like the companies like Adani's have preempted these legislations because between 2014 and 2020, when there was no possibility of hoarding this kind of amount of grains, huge silos are coming up in different parts of our country that the Adani Agri Logistics are setting up. So that is the second act. The third act, called the Farmers Empowerment Protection Agreement of Price Assurance and Farm Services Act, nowhere does it guarantee that the minimum support price would be ensured. It is actually promoting corporate contract farming, where the companies would be deciding what the Indian farmers have to grow. And we have earlier models here wherein naturally that would lead to shift in cropping patterns from food grains to commercial crops or crops and farm produce that is required by countries like United States or European Union or other developed capitalist countries. There have also been instances where people have lost land. Crops which are not at all consumed in India by the poor or the large masses of our population like, for instance, gherkin or bell peppers and so on, capsicum and so on, that are grown in this land. So it is against these three. These three come as a package. And if you see, from many years on, the World Trade Organization, there has been considerable pressure on India to cut their agricultural subsidies, food subsidies, and also to withdraw from public stockholding. A committee set up after the first Narendra Modi-led BJP government came to power in 2014, led by Shanta Kumar, one of the leaders of the ruling party, had recommended similarly that government withdraw from public stockholding and cut the subsidies for agriculture. That is what is being implemented in these through these three legislations. There is yet another legislation to privatize electricity. Electricity Act amendment that would cut subsidies on electricity, which would mean higher irrigation costs for farmers as well as higher electricity charges for the poor. So this is leading to this never before kind of unity of hundreds of organizations of farmers, an issue based unity calling for the repeal of these three anti-farmer acts.
The protests that began after this legislation was introduced, what kind of organization went into that? I'm sure they weren't purely spontaneous. So could you talk about how you've been organizing the farmers to resist these moves?
Doug, that is a very important question, because usually the media here tries to portray it as some spontaneous protests that have emerged all of a sudden. But I think between 2014 and 2020, meticulous issue-based unities have been built by the different farmers' organizations of our country. Initially in 2015, when the Modi-led BJP government came with the Land Acquisition Ordinance, an issue-based unity called the Land Rights Movement built around the issues of land rights as well as forest rights for people and against indiscriminate land grab or land acquisition for corporate profiteering, hundreds of organizations came together. In the course of struggles, they arrived at consensus on wider set of issues. Later, on two issues, that is the remunerative price, assured remunerative price for farm produce and freedom from indebtedness. Around this, another issue-based unity was built called the All India Kisan Sangharsh Coordination Committee. That would mean a All India Coordination Committee of farmers in struggle, which has now more than 250 organizations, small and big, spread across the country. So these struggles which have been going on, and also a unity of the workers and peasants that have been built up, that has resulted in this kind of a response. It has been continuously going on for the last 6 years. And once these acts were brought, first as ordinances, immediately within the very next day, in hundreds of places, almost 4,000 centers in our country, these ordinances were burnt. We had massive protests in a lockdown period when there are a lot of restrictions. The government had enough time to listen to the farmers and also bring changes, but they were not willing to do that. On 26th of November, the working class, the central trade unions, came together to call for a general strike. And in the same day, the call for march to Delhi call was given by these issue-based unities that we have built. And a massive march from Punjab and Haryana towards Delhi. Now, at five borders of Delhi, you have thousands and thousands of farmers who have gathered. It started on 26th of November. It is biting cold. Today, as I'm talking to you, it is also raining heavily in parts of Delhi. More than 50 farmers have died in this protest during this last little more than a month. The government remains insensitive to the plight of the farmers.
I'm speaking with Viju Krishnan, Joint Secretary of the All India Peasants Union. Now, you mentioned how the urban workers joined in with a call for a general strike. What are the relations between the farmers and the urban workers? Sometimes you might think their interests are opposed because urban workers want cheap food and farmers don't want cheap food. So what about the political relations between these two forces?
Often the ruling classes try to pit the workers against the farmers by saying that better price for farm produce leads to inflation and higher prices for the consumers. But here, what we see is that farm produce is procured very cheaply by these agribusinesses who profiteer at the expense of both the farmers as well as the consumers. During the lockdown period, as the attack on the farmers with these four acts, including the Electricity Act amendment, simultaneously, there is also an attack on the working class. The working class, the hard-won rights of 8 hours of work and 8 hours of leisure, no cut in pay. That was a slogan during the late 1880s. Today, the government is imposing 12 hours of work, hire and fire, thousands and thousands of people losing their jobs. According to an estimate, about 200 million Indian workers have lost their jobs during the lockdown period. There is no relief for the workers or the farmers. We had demanded an income support for all those sections who lost incomes during the lockdown period. However, while there is no loan waivers for the farmers, the big corporate willful defaulters, huge sum has been waived off for these corporate companies in the lockdown period. The government is protecting and facilitating corporate profiteering and at the expense of the farmers and workers of our country. That is why there is a never before kind of a worker peasant unity also emerging during the course of this struggle.
Let's talk a bit about the politics of this. When I interviewed Vijay Prashad the other week, he mentioned that this is a government and a party, the BJP, that loves to profess its love for the Indian nation, yet they don't seem to like the Indian people very much. How are these moves playing with the broad population? India is a democracy, and Modi has to face political consequences for this. How is this playing with the population?
Actually, there is no nation without its people. And this government has been, over the last 6 years, repeated onslaught on the common masses of our country. And democratic rights have been withdrawn. The voices of dissent have been suppressed in different ways. Writers, rationalists, and others have been killed in the initial few years of the government. Those out on protests have been branded as traitors and arrested under sedition laws and so on. And even now, when farmers have come out on protests, initial reaction was to brand them as separatists or supported by terrorists. When these did not stick, then they started charging that they are anti-national or they are supported by Pakistan or China and so on. None of these has stuck for once. The unity that has been created by the farmers, despite repeated efforts to divide the protests by the government, even some paid organizations have been sent. Antisocial elements have been sent to create disruption. Farmers have remained united. And with the strong solidarity, active solidarity actions by the working class, different sections of society coming forward. Wonderful solidarity called the Nation for Farmers, where you have writers for farmers, journalists for farmers, doctors for farmers, advocates for farmers. Every section, students and youth coming out in support. This is something we have never witnessed. At least I have been active with student politics and later with the farmer organization for almost 30 years now. We have not seen this kind of a protest. The massive nature, people have come prepared that we will not go back until and unless these anti-farmer acts are withdrawn.
What's different this time? What was it, just the legislation was so extreme, or has something changed in political consciousness?
In 2014, the BJP government and Mr. Modi had managed to raise a lot of hope by promising at least 50% more than the cost of production for farm produce and many other concessions to the farmers and the agriculture labor. But over the 6 years, we have seen that all promises have been betrayed. So that is one thing which has added to the anger of the peasantry and a realization that these acts, for the simple farmer of our country, a good number of whom may not have much of a formal education, they have understood that these legislations are meant to benefit the Adanis and Ambanis and the corporate cronies of our country, of this government. They realize that these acts are going to hit Indian agriculture, is going to put the future generations of the farming communities at danger. That is why they have come out in this large numbers. It is a fight to protect Indian agriculture, the fight to protect the peasant livelihoods in our country. that they have come forward in this unprecedented manner.
And what would the farmers like to see? What kind of restructuring of Indian agriculture would are people pressing for?
There are different levels we would like to pose these issues. Firstly, immediately repeal of these acts. That is an immediate demand. Along with that, another legislation to ensure that there would be at least 50% more than the cost of production for farm produce would be ensured. These are part of this present negotiations itself. However, when the new agriculture policy was brought in 1992 itself, organizations like ours had come up with an alternative agriculture policy. Many of those involve certain basic fundamental issues, demands like land rights, protection of the rights of the tribal communities. Similarly, regarding the social security measures for the agriculture labor, democratization of the countryside, and ensuring the irrigation infrastructure, easy access to irrigation, quality inputs, seeds and so on, and environmental protection, a wide-ranging, very holistically looking at agriculture. That was something which we had put forward. But in this pandemic period, there are certain other issues also which have come up. One is the issue of the health, universal health care, universal education, universal social security, food security, universal public distribution system. So these are also elements around which the present issue-based unity which we have built, there is need to expand it wider around these alternative set of policies, some of which are very well being implemented in the state of Kerala in our country, where millions of people are benefiting from social security pensions, being provided not just a token few kilograms of rice or wheat through the public distribution, but an entire food kit which would be enough for meeting the needs of the family for the whole month. And that kind of an intervention, how the public education system is being improved to such an extent that more and more people are now coming into the public education system. All these elements need to be part of a alternative that we put forward. And around that, there is the need for building a strong unity of the workers and peasants, the most oppressed sections. As you may be aware, you have the Dalit community, the Adivasi, the tribal communities, which face a lot of exploitation and oppression and discrimination in our country. Uniting all these sections and the youth and women around this alternative, we need to try and chart the course for building a new political alternative. I think that is what is required. In the last 6 years, the meticulous efforts that have gone in from different organizations of the peasantry, the farmers, the agriculture labor, the oppressed sections of our country, and the working class, I think that is a significant development in the independent India in more than seven decades of.
The Modi and BJP government have been using extreme nationalist appeals, whipping up anti-Muslim sentiment, dividing the population that way in the name of nationalism. How have those kinds of politics figured in with these very neoliberal pro-capitalist moves? I mean, are all those nationalist and anti-Muslim moves distraction from the neoliberal agenda? How do they fit together?
The agenda of communal fascism that the BJP government is trying to pursue has got ample support from a large section of the corporate cronies of the government. It has gone hand in hand. It is something that we have seen in world history also earlier, whether you talk about Hitler or such other regimes, where the capitalist class has been an active support for these set of policies. Here also, unfortunately in India also, with few maybe very rare exceptions which are there, there are few honorable exceptions. Otherwise, whether it is the corporate media or different companies, they have stood by this government. There is a scope for a wider alternative media and such sections which are intervening through different platforms, which even amidst these dark times are resisting. But that is not there from within the capitalist sections in that manner. So they have been usually going hand in glove with the government.
Okay, and then finally, where's this going? You said that the farmers are still protesting. You're going to continue this, or do you have some plans for the future?
We have charted a course for intensifying this struggle. We have had on the 5th of December, effigies of the Prime Minister and the two corporate entities which have come to symbolize are at the receiving end of these protests, the Adanis and Ambanis. Their effigies were burnt in thousands and thousands of places across the country. This is something unimaginable a few years back. People have been boycotting the products of Ambanis and Adanis in a big way, to such an extent that they were today forced to come out with statements that they are not against the farmers, they are not wanting to enter into contract farming and so on, trying to issue some clarifications. People have been porting out of the Jio mobile network connections. They have been going out of it. So these are something which we have not seen before. In coming days, we intend to have a massive campaign across the country on these three acts and the Electricity Act amendments, as well as the changes that have been brought, the labor code, labor laws, that dilution of the rights of the laborers, or withdrawal of the rights of the labor. We are going to have a almost 20-day campaign till 20th of January, 23rd to 26th of January. 26th is also the Republic Day in India. We are going to have continuous sit-ins in all state capitals, where thousands would sit in protest against these acts. On the 26th, we will also have a parade of, usually you have the national parade here with defense equipments and so on by the official government. But the farmers and workers parade would be held across the country. We feel that this unity and the resolute manner in which the farmers and workers are carrying on, this government will be forced to bow down before this united protest. Today, there was a set of talks. The government has sought time again on 8th of this month. And tomorrow, the Supreme Court is also looking into this matter. We are sure that our united struggle will force this government, and the defeat that we will hand them over is going to also open gates for new political developments and a transformation in coming times.
That was Viju Krishnan, Joint Secretary of the All India Peasants Union. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Peace in the Shape of a Square for two flutes, with both parts played by Claire Chase. Next, the minimum wage. Although the federal minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, hasn't been raised since 2009, states and localities are increasingly taking matters into their own hands. According to a new report from the National Employment Law Project, a total of 52 jurisdictions, 20 states and 32 cities and counties, will raise their minimum wages this year. Another 23 jurisdictions will raise their minimums later in the year. In 27 cities and counties, the minimum will be $15 an hour or more. 11 states and 24 localities will index their minimums to inflation. Later in the year, another 13 cities will hit or exceed $15 an hour. These increases are in no small part the result of a Fight for 15 movement that began in 2012. With a new configuration of power in Washington, we may, emphasis on may, given the Dems' history in this area, see pressure to do something about the federal minimum,
which has lost 18% of its real value since the 2009 increase. That increase took the minimum from 35% of the average hourly wage to 39% of it. It's now eroded to 29% of the average. Bringing it back to its real value back then would require an increase to $8.81. Taking it back to 39% of the average wage would require an increase to almost $10 an hour. Although only about 2% of hourly workers earn the federal minimum, many more are paid close to it, and raising the minimum would bump them up as well. A tenth of all workers make less than $10.35 an hour, but about a quarter of all cashiers and childcare workers make less than that. Curious parenthetical fact, speaking of childcare workers, they make a median of $11.65 an hour, less than parking lot attendants, who are paid a median of $12.09 an hour. The fact that almost all childcare workers are women and almost all parking lot attendants are men might have something to do with that. And back to the federal minimum wage, any non-trivial federal increase could have significant regional and sectoral effects. Here's the author of that National Employment Law Project report, Janet Lathrop, senior research and policy analyst at the group, with more. Janet Lathrop.
So a remarkable number of workers are getting a wage increase, minimum wage workers are getting a wage increase as the year turns. What's the scope of it? How many states, how many localities, and how many people are involved?
So in total, it's 24 states for the full year and 50 localities. On or about New Year's Day, the states were 20 that turned to higher minimum wages, and the localities were 32. So there are a huge number of localities and states that are going that are raising wages in 2021.
Now, politically, can we trace this all back to the Fight for 15?
I would think so. Before the Fight for 15, there were only a limited a number of places where there were any minimum wage campaigns. I think in 2006, there were a few, maybe in the Southwest and Florida also. But it wasn't until 2012, when the Fight for 15 began, that things started really building up for as far as campaigns and wins for higher wages.
Now, a lot of the states and localities involved are doing this in a very gradual, stepwise fashion, right? It's not all happening once.
No, yeah. For many of these places, the increases are taking place over a number of years.
And now there's this idea, people who oppose minimum wage increases, of course, argue, among other things, that minimum wage workers are typically just kids, you know, picking up an extra few bucks. That's not really true, right? Who are the minimum wage workers?
Well, that might have been true many, many decades ago. Now, minimum wage workers tend to be adults. Over 20 is a huge percentage of them are over 20. A lot of them are actually in their 30s and even 40s. A lot of these people are people that I believe, what, a quarter nationwide are people who are raising children. And definitely over 20 is the most likely minimum wage worker.
And of course, the argument is also that it destroys jobs. What do you say when people make that claim?
The research does not back up that argument. The bulk of the research on the minimum wage has found that minimum wage increases do increase the earnings of workers who are affected without really affecting employment, either positive or negative.
Another argument is that workers get tips and supplement the minimum wage. How did tipping relate to the minimum wage?
Unfortunately, we haven't seen as much on the tipped wage as we would like to see. The workers who earn a tip in most states, other than seven, which are called one fair wage states, but typically the tipped workers will earn only a fraction of the full minimum wage in base payment and in base pay, and then they will earn tips to compensate for the rest of their wages. Typically, the law requires that if a tipped worker does not earn at least the minimum wage between base wage and tips, then the employer has to compensate them to make sure that they at least earn the minimum wage per hour. But it's hard to enforce that. So there's a lot of wage theft that we know of in the restaurant industries and other industries that rely on the tipped wage.
Now, this is now covering, what, something like 40% of workers in the country, right? Now, this legislation locally and state-wise. But that means an awful lot of people are not covered. And a lot of states are just resorting to the federal minimum, which is, what, $7.75 an hour now?
$7.25 an hour. $7.25 an hour. Yes, since 2009. So it's been a very long time since workers who are paid at the federal minimum wage have seen a raise.
So even though the inflation is relatively low now, not raising the minimum wage for over 11 years means that the value of that is, what, maybe 20%, 30, 25% lower than what it was then. So there are an awful lot of people, you know, we have some good news in this report. A lot of states and localities seeing significant increases in the minimum wage, but an awful lot of workers across the country are still trying to get by on that minimum, right?
Right. In 20 states, the applicable minimum wage is only $7.25 an hour. So there are a significant number of workers who are really working for poverty wages. In the case of these states, the most likely way to raise wages, because in a lot of these states are also the legislatures are not inclined to raise wages at the state or local level. So for these workers in these 20 states, the most likely way to raise wages is by raising the federal minimum wage. And we haven't had so far a whole lot of good luck in raising the federal minimum wage. But we'll see what happens this year if the Democrats do have control of the Senate after today's elections in Georgia. There may be something could happen at the federal level, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, although, you know, when the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress under Bill Clinton, they didn't raise the minimum wage, and they did it once under Obama, but not again. So that's not necessarily all that promising.
No. And so we'll have to be honest. I mean, even if the Democrats do control the Senate, it will, you know, there'll be still need for very strong campaign on the federal level. And, you know, that's still not a guarantee that a minimum wage will pass. But, you know, I guess it's more likely, perhaps, I don't know how much more likely, but more likely under a Democratic administration with a Democratic Congress than it would be under a Republican one.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Mitch McConnell embracing this agenda. Now, the pandemic has really brought forward the plight of a lot of people who are working at or close to the minimum wage, right? I mean, this is just, you know, the essential workers are not paid in accordance with their essentialness.
Right. And, you know, the pandemic has really shown is not only that they're not being paid in accordance with their essentialness, as you put it, but also that they in general, their work is so important. Grocery store workers, the workers who work in retail and in the food service industry, etc., their work is so important. And we are just now realizing how important it is. They are the ones who have been, in addition to healthcare workers, have been the one who the workers who have been really keeping the country running while the rest of us, you know, I guess stay at home and do safe work from our home. It's now, are we going to be able to convince folks who have the power to pay them higher wages that they should be paid more? We'll see at the federal level, but hopefully there will be some good news at the state and local levels this year as well. Maybe we'll see a few more campaigns that will raise wages for these essential workers in the coming year.
And I meant to bring this up before, but I should say it again, that a disproportionate number of the workers who are at or close to the minimum wage. And it's important that whenever the minimum wage is raised, people close to the minimum also see wage increases. So that really, it affects far more people than are just, you know, right at that line. But you say in your report, the power of workers of color coming together and organizing cannot be underestimated. The workers disproportionately are Black and brown, and the movement is led by those sorts of workers, right?
Correct. Well, so the workers that are earning low wages, it really depends on where in the country you're looking at. But typically, numerically, just nominally, the workers, white workers, tend to be more numerous. But when you look at the proportion of workers of various racial or ethnic backgrounds who are earning minimum wages, workers of color tend to be more likely to earn low wages than white workers, if that makes sense.
And then finally, this actually is fairly popular, right? I mean, it polls well. There's broad public support for it, so it's only the meanness of employers and their paid politicians that that block it.
Correct. I think Florida is a good example of how popular the minimum wage can be as an issue. Florida went for Trump, and yet voters there passed a higher minimum wage of $15 by 2026. That's, I think, a pretty significant in and of itself, but also an example of how popular this can be with voters of all political stripes. And also, about this is when you take a look at, in general, at ballot proposals, if you put the minimum wage before voters anywhere in the country, they are very likely to pass the higher wage. And we've seen only one, I believe it was back in 2014, in one small city in California, I believe, where a ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage did not pass. But other than that, in the years that I've been tracking minimum wage increases and minimum wage campaigns, I've seen ballot proposals that have raised wages nearly all the time.
That was Janet Lathrop, senior analyst at the National Employment Law Project. And now, organizing tech workers. A few months ago, I interviewed Ben Tarnoff about unionizing Silicon Valley, and also Ben and his co-editor, Moira Weigel, about what tech workers have to say about their labors. Here's a fresh development in this story, a union at Google. Google is seen by many as a great place to work, good pay, interesting tasks, and open culture. But dissatisfaction has been mounting. A couple of years ago, women walked out of the company for a day to protest rampant sexual harassment, discrimination, and pervasive racism. And then late last year, the company fired Timnit Gebru, an artificial intelligence expert of Ethiopian origin, who'd written a paper critical of AI systems for, among other things, wasting huge amounts of energy and also embodying racist and sexist assumptions. Her research into the ethics of AI clearly made the bosses uncomfortable. The company has long forgotten its founding motto, "Do no evil." Earlier this week, the creation of an Alphabet Workers Union, Alphabet is Google's parent company, was announced. The Communications Workers of America, CWA, has been assisting in the effort. Here's union member Alex Peterson with more. Alex Peterson. So what were the issues that prompted this drive and the formation of the Alphabet Workers Union?
Well, there were a number of things. You know, obviously, there was, in 2018, there was the events that led up to the women's walkout. In 2019, there was the firing of the Thanksgiving Four and the institution of cryptic new policies that seem to have the intention of chilling the company culture and the sense of unity within the company so that information was more and more siloed. And finally, the firing of Timnit Gebru was a really galvanizing moment for a lot of people. And in December, we ended up getting enough people that we could handle a surge of membership that would occur when we went public. The overarching issues, and there'll be many more that we can cover based on what we hear from each other, is that a lot of us are thought of as more disposable to the company, and the open culture that attracted us to the company and its sense of corporate responsibility has just been declining.
Yeah, now that old "do no evil" mantra seems to have been retired, at least to an outside observer. Is that true?
Right. It was officially removed from company documentation. Although some might call it just a token thing and maybe it's not legally useful language, it shows the move towards conventionality and the loss of very important components of what made Google special and what made us all hopeful about it.
Now, there's some people, mainly, I suppose, confined to Twitter, but, you know, if everybody pays attention to Twitter, unfortunately. But there's people complaining that you're really a bunch of privileged workers, and why do you need unions? The people who really need unions are Amazon warehouse workers. What do you say to that critique that, you know, you guys are just pretty well off, so why do you need a union?
Arguably, everyone is more well off than people in the 17th century or in the 15th century, but human life is largely about making things better for our entire community. We're a union that includes and invites temporary vendors and contractors into the union in order to support them in any, hypothetically, if they want support in creating a bargaining unit, then we can figure that out. And although we're also inspired by a lot of the work that was already done by the contract workers in Pittsburgh, as well as the Bay Area cafeteria workers who have largely unionized, at least 2,300 of them. The reason that software engineers, for example, are also in the union is because we, although we don't have as dire of a need for higher wages or benefits, there are still quite a few gaps in how the benefit structure works. And because we have such an expertise on the technologies that we work on, we think it's very important to advocate not just for ourselves, but for our common interest with all of our users.
You mentioned contract workers and such. Has Google been using more and more of those rather than permanent employees?
Yes, they're actually the majority of the workforce now.
So they're, about 200-some members of the union, initially was the number I read?
I believe it's over 500 now.
Oh, well, it's growing rapidly. But, you know, it's obviously Alphabet has many, many more employees than that. What is your strategy for being such a small, although growing group in such a very large organization?
Right. You know, there are no shortcuts to this process. We are going to be very vigilant in our work and talking to one another and understanding our common interest with each other, within our teams, even at lunch, perhaps. We understand that it's probably going to be a very long time before we reach anywhere near a majority, but it's important to understand that Public Citizen, for example, started as 200 people. They're responsible for really important victories like that all of us consumers take for granted, such as airbags in cars. And a number of other organizations began as fewer than 200 people as well, but when issues such as national parks or other things. We're also extremely focused on balancing our perspectives as we bring people in.
Any reaction of harassment or anything like that coming out of the company?
I haven't seen any personally. We know that certain methods of retaliation have been tried in the past. An example that people may not be aware of is if you're not actually complaining of an illness or anything, and then your manager tells you that you should take some long-term leave or a few months of leave just to calm down or something, that is a form of retaliation. But I haven't seen that so far in this current announcement, but that happened to one of the walkout organizers.
That's fine. I mean, it's hard to imagine a manager telling you to take a long break, but it's kind of anti-manager behavior. Now, what else is going on in the Valley? Or I guess the Valley is now dispersed considerably, but using the Valley the way people use Wall Street as a sector or a frame of mind rather than just a pure geographic location. Are there organizing efforts going on? Are you in touch with other people who are trying to organize around the tech industry?
At the moment, we're still working on specializing ourselves. We are in contact with the worker agency. They've been doing some really valuable work for us. And of course, just by becoming part of CWA, the Communication Workers of America, through the Code CWA program, that means that we put in our common resources with over 700 other workers for companies such as AT&T, which are arguably an important part of the tech sector. We would like to work with emerging. Anybody is welcome to contact us if they're trying to organize their workplace, and we can see what we can do.
What is the role of CWA? Are they helping in the organizing effort?
That's right. We have some dedicated staff to help us, and that's been incredibly important in what we've been trying to do over the past month in order to get ready to go public and figure out how to keep things stable when the majority of members is very, very new. It's largely in terms of staff helping us coordinate things with ourselves and with just having their experience with PR, things like that.
And then finally, this show originates in the Bay Area, although it has a worldwide listenership. But what advice would you offer to any other tech workers who might be listening how they might get started down this path?
Well, I think the hardest part is just finding each other. I would say wear red, maybe try to identify each other that way on Thursdays. I think, you know, it really is hard, but you just have to talk to people as much as you can, if you can, and try to get a sense of where they are and what they think organizing could help with. And also contact people with experience and ask them questions. We care about making this whole industry valuable for people more so than for machines. And because of the great thematic nature of that struggle, we really are in it together as human beings. So don't be afraid to reach out.
And since almost every one of us these days uses an Alphabet product, anything that this vast array of users could do to help you out?
You know, I hadn't thought about that. We could definitely just use your public support in the public discussion. I don't think that users can really apply all too much leverage except as creators, although there's been talk about what we can do to help standardize the relationship between streaming platforms and the artists that use them.
That was Alex Peterson of the Alphabet Workers Union. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this. More from the flutist Clara Chase. This is some of Density 21 by Edgar Varese. Till next week, bye.